From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman arrived on Capitol Hill this morning, decked out in his blue military uniform and medals, to testify as part of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. He's a Ukraine expert on the National Security Council and was part of the small listening group in on the president's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Vindman is the first official on that call to testify. In a draft of his opening statement released this morning, Vindman said, quote, "I was concerned by the call. I did not think it was proper to demand that a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen." He said the push to investigate Biden would undermine U.S. national security. Greg Jaffe is national security reporter for The Washington Post and joins us now. Greg, welcome.
Thanks very much.
So Alexander Vindman, who we should say wants to make clear he is not the whistleblower, said in his statement that he reported his concerns to the legal counsel of the National Security Council. Can you explain more about what his concerns were?
Sure. He comes out of a meeting in July with Ambassador Bolton, Fiona Hill, who's his boss, and two senior Ukrainian officials, and Ambassador Gordon Sondland, who's a big Trump donor and the ambassador to the EU. And he comes out of that meeting very concerned that essentially Sondland is putting pressure on the Ukrainians to open up an investigation into Joe Biden in exchange for an Oval Office meeting with President Trump. And that meeting's really important to the Ukrainians.
How does this fit in with what we've been hearing from other witnesses in this inquiry?
So this really corroborates and bolsters what we've heard from previous witnesses, both Fiona Hill, who is the director for Russia and Europe on the National Security Council, essentially Vindman's boss, and Ambassador Bill Taylor, who is the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Essentially, all three of them are telling the same story and a slightly different story than Gordon Sondland told. So they really have a lot of credibility because they all kind of seem to be on the same page, where he seems to be kind of a little bit off in left field.
So Sondland is the outlier here, who we should also say is a Trump donor.
Yeah, a really big Trump donor, gave, I think, $1 million to Trump's inaugural fund. And essentially that money bought him the ambassadorship.
Can you remind us of what Sondland said in his testimony?
He essentially testifies a little bit to the effect that he didn't realize or even understand the notion that Trump was withholding this meeting in exchange for a political investigation into Biden. He says he didn't understand that Burisma, which is this natural gas company on which Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, serves, that essentially asking for an investigation into Burisma was asking for an investigation into former Vice President Biden. Sondland says he doesn't understand that, and he sort of muddies the waters as to whether there was a clear quid pro quo or not.
Yeah, and he's the only outlier, as you said.
Yeah, his story seems significantly different from everyone else. He's really the other interesting thing about Sondland is he's really the lead on this with Kurt Volker, who's the special envoy to Ukraine, and Rick Perry, the energy secretary. The three of them call them the three amigos. And Sondland really seems to be driving this train, but at the same time sort of claims not to understand the policy that he's driving. So it's a little bit, I guess, difficult to believe.
Vindman also said in his statement that he never had direct contact or communication with the president and that he's also not partisan. Tell us a little bit more about his background.
So he's got a fascinating background. He comes from the former Soviet Union when he's 3 years old. He speaks Ukrainian and Russian, talks about growing up in Brooklyn, I think in Brighton Beach, and being pressured by his father. His mother dies in the Soviet Union, to really assimilate into American culture. He and his brother, who's a twin, both join the army. They both work together at the NSC. His brother is a lawyer on the NSC. And I think the one thing that comes through from his statement is this is a guy who really buys into a U.S. Army officer's loyalty is to the Constitution and to the country, not to a political party and not to any single individual.
He also has a Purple Heart after being wounded in an IED attack while serving in Iraq. Yes, he has really pushed that he is patriotic, and that is a big part of what he wanted the public to know about him. Vindman's testimony comes a day after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that she will hold a vote to affirm the impeachment inquiry this Thursday. What does this vote mean for the inquiry, and what's next?
I think what it's designed to do is to sort of take away a Republican talking point that this inquiry has been conducted in secret, that the president is not getting due process or his rights. This is an effort to sort of take away that talking point, I think. I don't think it changes anything in the near term, but it will set a clear schedule in terms of when things will become public and how things will proceed going forward.
Will this also push for, I know we've been talking about John Bolton and him testifying as well, will that push the direction towards getting folks who have either been silent or have refused to testify to testify?
I don't know. That still remains to be seen. But I think Bolton's testimony, you're right to hone in on that one. That one's really critical because the one thing we don't have so far is a person in the room with President Trump describing Trump's directions, his opinions on Ukraine. And Bolton really supplies that to us.
Greg Jaffe is national security reporter for The Washington Post. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Happy to do it.
Well, the federal government's Bureau of Land Management has announced that it's moving its headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Colorado. The decision is controversial, and depending on who you talk to, it will either make the BLM more efficient or give preferential treatment to the fossil fuel industry. Noah Glick of member station KUNR reports.
Grand Junction, Colorado is where the BLM is setting up its new base. The mid-sized town of about 63,000 people is named for the meeting spot of the mighty Colorado and Gunnison Rivers. A city tourism video puts it like this.
Grand Junction is where the Rocky Mountains give way to the natural beauty of the Southwest, and the differences are dramatic. There's nowhere else like it. Just look around and you can...
By the end of next year, 27 BLM staffers are scheduled to move from the nation's capital to this idyllic town halfway between Denver and Salt Lake City. And hundreds more will be scattered across the West. Grand Junction Mayor Rick Taggart says the shakeup will give his city a stronger political voice.
As a smaller city in western Colorado, we're not as well known. And because of that, sometimes we don't have the voice even in our state government that we'd like to have.
Industry also stands to benefit. According to Jeremy Gelman, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he studies congressional partisanship and agenda setting.
So in the case of BLM, mining interests, logging companies, farmers, ranchers, their locus of power, their sort of epicenter of where most of their people are is out west. And Republicans want those folks easy access to BLM when regulations are being written.
And some of those folks will be close, very close. The Grand Junction headquarters will be in the same building as a corporate office for Chevron, Laramie Energy, an oil and gas producer, and a Colorado State Oil and Gas Association office. In a statement, a BLM spokesperson said any suggestion that the location was chosen to give select interest groups special access is, quote, flagrant and ironic. Gelman says it's hard to know the intentions behind the decision. But overall, he says there's no doubt the move will make it easier for industry interests to access BLM bureaucrats and harder for national environmental groups.
For really big stuff, you're going to expect all the big players to show up. But for the smaller day-to-day stuff, who you're hearing from, what's important, what's not important, that sort of access does matter. It's not everything, but it does sort of tilt the playing field a little bit to who can talk to those bureaucrats and who can get that face-to-face time.
That's a selling point for Utah Congressman Rob Bishop. He's the ranking Republican on the House Natural Resources Committee. He says moving the BLM out west will put agents closer to the lands they manage and the interests of those lands.
Having people on the ground who have the ability of making the final decision, not just having a job there locally, but also having the ability of making those decisions, that's going to be a net plus. That's going to benefit people.
Not everyone agrees. Many BLM employees have expressed frustration over the move, and the investigative nonprofit ProPublica reported that since mid-July, 11 BLM employees have already quit, with more resignations expected to come. That has some Democrats and environmental groups worried that losing these seasoned staffers could further strengthen the influence of the oil and gas industry. But Bishop doesn't buy that.
Why could simply the gas and oil industry have more influence than, say, an environmental group that's out there or a cattle ranger that's out there? I mean, I'm sorry, that's an argument that you come up with to try and find some reason to stop a logical move from going forward. There is no merit to that.
The rationale for it is hard to figure out. In fact, I don't think there is one.
That's House Natural Resources Committee Chairman Raul Grijalva, a Democrat.
Given the track record of this administration, particularly the Department of Interior, there seem to be whole bet on making sure that gas and oil are taken care of and the fossil fuel industry is taken care of, above anything else.
Grijalva says his committee has not been given enough information on the types of jobs moving west, and he's concerned about decision-making positions being so far away from Congress.
The last thing you want is little fiefdoms in each state making their own decisions and doing their own procedures. And I think that's part of the intention, to allow a state that is all for extraction and nothing else to have the freedom to do that without any oversight by the federal government to the law and to other requirements.
Grijalva says he's prepared to issue subpoenas if the committee doesn't get the information it's looking for. The House and Senate have both refused to provide funding for the move in the latest budget, but a Department of Interior spokesperson says the relocation is moving forward, using funding previously approved by Congress. The BLM could be in its new home by the end of next year. For Here and Now, I'm Noah Glick.
And Noah's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
More blackouts are expected today across Northern California as wildfires continue to rage in many parts of the state. California's largest utility company, Pacific Gas and Electric, says the latest outages will affect more than 500,000 customers, and many of them are already in the dark. The intention, of course, is to save lives, but for medically vulnerable people, like those who rely on breathing machines and other equipment, time without power can be life-threatening. Joining us now to talk more about this is Yomi Rong of Oakland. She works in the healthcare industry as an advocate for the disabled. Yomi also has bone brittle disease and uses an electric wheelchair to get around. Yomi, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So you've been trying to raise awareness about the impact blackouts have on people with disabilities. What do you want people to know?
Boy, I mean, there's just so much for people to know. We have rolling blackouts, as you've just mentioned. My power is still on, but just a mile or so away, I have friends who have been without power for a couple of days. The community of people with disabilities and our allies, we're just not relying on local government or even PG&E to help us. We're raising funds and developing mutual aid networks so that people who need support can get it. There are about 20 volunteers kind of centered around East Oakland that are fielding requests from individuals and families who need everything from hotel vouchers to backup power, or even just to go into their homes and seal up windows and doors. Because although we are quite a ways from the fire with the winds, the smoke has traveled to the greater Bay Area. So folks with respiratory issues are really feeling those effects as well.
And when it comes to the power outages, you've said that 24-hour warning is not enough. That's what PG&E gives, and that it's very ableist. People on fixed incomes can't afford things like generators. Can you talk a little bit about how you've been impacted by these planned power outages? I know you mentioned you still have power right now, but it could be imminent.
You know, when you have a utility like PG&E telling people, well, in the next 24 hours or even 48 hours, we're going to cut off your power for maybe 1 to 3 or 5 days, it assumes that people who are able-bodied or well-resourced would be able to quickly either get backup power or go to hotels or travel to places outside of the planned shutoff zones. And that just is not the reality for anybody with access and functional needs. I have a job, I have a car, I have a dual income family, and I still can't afford the level of solar generator that I would need to be able to keep my life going at home. So what I've done, I have a power wheelchair that I use primarily. I have a older wheelchair in my shed. I have kept that one charged just in case. It's just really difficult to find the resources that you need. There are independent living centers across the state that PG&E is just now getting around to kind of standing up grant programs where independent living centers will be able to provide hotel vouchers, some backup power support. But they can't help everybody. What we need are more resources specifically from PG&E because they can certainly afford it.
Yomi, this feels like deja vu. Back in 2001, PG&E had these rolling blackouts to cut the use of electricity during the state's energy crisis back then. And back then, several disability agencies were pushing for statewide early warning systems and amenities like a toll-free emergency hotline and even charging stations. I was just floored when I read this because 20 years later, you're basically asking for the same things. What is your message to PG&E and really the state? How do you want them to support you?
You know, PG&E needs to be providing local governments with resources to be able to reach residents. We need very hyper-local, neighborhood-by-neighborhood-based resources.
Yomi, what can non-disabled people do to support their disabled friends and neighbors during these events?
I would say be allies. Find out what the community needs. We need for everybody to join with us so that nobody is left behind in these kinds of scenarios.
Yomi Rong is an advocate for the disability community in California. She lives in Oakland. Yomi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Staying with energy, Murray Energy, the country's largest private coal company, just became the eighth in the country to file for bankruptcy in the past year. And Robert Murray, a coal booster who held a big fundraiser for President Trump last summer and has filed lawsuits against a federal rule meant to prevent black lung in miners, stepped down as the company's CEO. It turns out that despite President Trump's claims that he will bring back coal through clean coal energy, the market had other ideas, turning to renewables and natural gas. Gregory Marmon is principal coal analyst with Wood Mackenzie. Greg, tell us more. What's going on?
Well, Murray Energy, the vast majority of its mines are profitable and producing cash flow. It's just the massive expansion he undertook in the last few years where he expanded into Northern Appalachian underground mines, expanded into his purchase of Foresight Energy. He took on a lot of debt, and that is in a very low price environment at the moment is causing a lot of problems.
Is this just an industry or industry leaders willfully blind to what the market was doing, you know, demanding more renewables, for instance?
Partially, yes. The price of natural gas is barely above $2 at the moment, and then definitely a significant amount of renewable energy development and the price of developing new projects of renewable energy has come down significantly. Most of this debt that he took on was probably a few years ago where there were different expectations of the market at that time.
It looks pretty bad. I mean, we're reading that the U.S. Energy Information Administration is forecasting a 10% drop in American coal production in 2019. Wyoming. We're always surprised when we're reminded that Wyoming is the country's largest coal producer, accounting for more than 40% of coal output. Coal production there in just the first half of this year is down 30%. It seems pretty bad.
It's very bad in the industry at the moment. Low-cost renewable energy and even lower-cost natural gas has definitely caused a lot of heartaches in the industry.
Yeah.
You know, the increase in rates of mine closures as natural gas production continues to rise and renewable energy production continues to increase.
Well, and is this also the difference between different kinds of ways that coal can be used?
Metallurgical coal is still very profitable at the moment for the majority of U.S. mines, but that's still only about 10% of the U.S. coal market produces metallurgical quality coal.
And remind us, that's metallurgical coal as opposed to thermal coal. Remind us the difference.
Metallurgical coal is used to produce coke, which is used in the steelmaking process.
Mm-hmm.
It is used in the reduction of raw iron ore into finished steel, while thermal coal is only used at power plants or industrial processes to produce mostly electricity, but there is some industrial heat uses.
Right. And that's the kind that we tend to think of, and that is the biggest percentage of coal use, and that is way down. We're also reading there's a shipping problem here. Western states, including Washington State, aren't allowing coal through their ports. They're citing environmental concerns. How big an impact is that?
Very, very. That would at least partially pay the partial problem for Cloud Peak, which declared bankruptcy a couple months ago. What happened there was with a fall in demand for subbituminous coal, they tried to expand to the international market, and they've been unable to do so. So that played a part in their bankruptcy.
Remind us what happens when there's a bankruptcy. Companies have to pay off their debtors first, and that doesn't include workers. I mean, how do bankruptcies impact workers? We remember profiling coal workers who were protesting. They were literally striking, sitting on a train track, protesting that when their company, Black Jewel, went out, you know, the workers, they didn't keep their salary obligations to workers. They had to pay off other debts. They finally, just a few days ago, got those payouts. But workers are often the most hurt in these bankruptcies. And remind us what happened to Black Jewel.
Black Tool was a very sudden bankruptcy to the company and to the community around it. It presented a very positive viewpoint, and all of a sudden cash flow stopped and they started bouncing checks a few weeks before. And very rarely in the coal industry do you see mines that are still producing positive cash flow just shut down, but that happened to Black Tool the day they declared bankruptcy.
Yeah. The EIA, the Energy Information Administration, is also projecting out another 17 gigawatts of coal production will go offline by 2025. Coal stockpiles at power plants are already at the lowest level in a decade. Is there any way this might be reversed?
It's extremely unlikely at the moment. We might see it stabilize for a few years, but in terms of reversals, it does appear to be very unlikely. You know, our projections and the projections from the EIA in terms of natural gas production and price levels, and then the projections of the development of new renewable energy, it does not suggest that there's going to be any real reversal in the coal industry. What we kind of see is it's going to stabilize at its current levels. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a few more mine closures across the industry, just reflect in the new stable system.
Yeah. It seems as if the future of coal is a very short one, projecting out. What would you tell coal executives? What would you tell coal workers?
Our projections going out in the next 20 years, we do see steadily decreasing levels of coal production and coal demand, just as power plants close and the renewable energy developments continue to increase. So right now, in 2019, we have a little bit over 700 million short tons of domestic coal production, and we do see it falling pretty low in the next 5 years.
Yeah, just read the projections. Gregory Marmon, Principal Coal Analyst with Wood Mackenzie. Gregory, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Google's parent company, Alphabet, reportedly wants to buy Fitbit. If the sale goes ahead, it would make Google a major player in the market for fitness trackers. It could also open the door for Google to compete with Apple's smartwatch and make a splash in the broader market for wearable technology. Paresh Dave broke the news. He's technology correspondent for Reuters. And Paresh, we still don't know whether this deal will happen or what Google reportedly offered Fitbit. But really, the big question is, why would a company like Google want to buy Fitbit?
Google has really been investing in developing its own hardware the last few years. And that's because it's seeing companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, all of its, you know, big rivals also invest in hardware. And these smartwatches, these fitness trackers, wearables, whatever you want to call what Fitbit makes, they're another opportunity to put a computer with you at a time when you might not have a phone right next to you when you're working out, for instance.
Right, right. Fitbit's stock price surged 27% after this news yesterday. Google's went up by 2%. Why do investors like this idea?
For Fitbit, the issue is that the company's sort of been struggling the last few years. A few years ago, the stock was at around almost $50. Now it's barely pushing $5. you know, a few years ago, Fitbit was the thing that, people wanted. They had this whole gamification element, you know, where you'd be competing against your friends and everyone would be talking about their like Fitbit scores. That's gone by the wayside thanks to, Apple and what Apple has been able to do with its watch and, sort of make it the, must-have item. On the Alphabet and Google side, you know, Amazon's not yet in wearables. And so this is an opportunity to, sort of push ahead.
Fitbit, when it came out back in 2007, it was really one of the only devices in the world known as wearable tech. But how big is this market for wearable tech and how much of it does Fitbit actually claim right now?
Yeah, one of the, questions is whether the, novelty of this has worn off and you know, whether it was sort of a fad. You know, whenever I see a smartwatch, it's a, it's usually an Apple Watch.
I know my Fitbit is collecting dust in, one of the drawers. It's not something that I've really been seeing lately either.
And it's surprising because a lot of the, early reviews of the device said that it, you know, it has the best software around. But, you know, at this point, you know, they're under 10% market share and there's a lot of questions about how much bigger the, smartwatch market gets. So I think that's the, opportunity Google sees to, put sort of new life into this brand.
You mentioned Apple Watch. Earlier this year, Google bought some smartwatch IP from the Fossil Group for about $40 million. Do we know what Google plans to do with that? Are they getting into the smartwatch market?
The plans for that are sort of unclear at this point. But, you know, we do know that Google a few years ago was working on a watch. They did look at the idea. And there's been a lot of questions over the last couple of years. When is Google's Pixel smartwatch going to come out? And, Pixel is what they call their, smartphone and other devices. So there's been a lot of speculation about that and certainly user interest in such a device.
We will definitely be watching this potential acquisition from Google of Fitbit. Thank you so much. That's Paresh Dave. He's technology correspondent for Reuters. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And it's exhausting, just ticking off Twyla Tharp's achievements. At 78, she's created more than 150 dances for her own company, as well as the New York City Ballet, Paris Opera Ballet, the Danish Ballet, and Baryshnikov. Here's part of the score for Push Comes to Shove. Tharp's also choreographed the films Hair and Amadeus, won a Tony for the Billy Joel musical Moving Out, picked up two Emmys, a MacArthur Fellowship, and been inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. So, she will no doubt find some comfortable laurels on which to rest, right? Oh, wrong, wrong, wrong. When Twyla Tharp is waiting for something like a subway, she'll go over dance routines with subtle movements. Dancers call it marking. She says we mere mortals can take the stairs, jump rope, the most efficient way back from injury. Take up space, dancers call it amplitude, stride into a meeting, and push against things, meaning isometrics, but also push back against the notion that getting older obligates you to recede. Twyla Tharp's new book is Keep It Moving, and she's at NPR's New York studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
Can we start with an isometric, put our palms together?
I think that better than your palms together, which is resisting yourself, find another object, anything, a wall, the floor, and just push as hard as you possibly can for as long as you possibly can. It's a resistance exercise. It's the basis upon which all calisthenics operates, and it is, as you indicated, a measure of the simple fact that you will find obstacles no matter what age you are, but that the body, if it's tended, is going to do better with those obstacles than if you just let it go its own way and hang out in a corner somewhere and not exercise.
Just sit in a heap. Well, I just did push against my desk and felt my stretch my calves. I did put my palms together in front of me and pushed, stood up straighter. It made me pull in my stomach muscles too.
Excellent. Very good. See there?
These little moves count.
Of course they do. The little moves become big moves and big moves become little moves, right? I think that's one of the problems a lot of folks wait for when they know exactly how to do something or when they're an expert or competent. The bad news is you will never be, so you might as well start somewhere like here and now.
We love that phrase. You also talk about, I think you were a very young dancer and you went to audition for the Rockettes. And they tell you to smile?
They say, young lady, you really dance very well, indicating you can have this job, but could you smile? And indicates to me that really I don't want that job. That to me is an imposition on what one really has of your own, which is your intention. What is your intention? Now, it is also true the Rockettes are in the business of entertainment, and that for the most part, their public will rather see happy people on stage than not happy people on stage, okay? Somehow at a young age, I did not understand those dense, complicated maneuvers and just decided this was not a life that I wanted to pursue. It was up to everybody else on their own time to figure out whether they wanted to smile or not. Right. I was not going to tell them that.
Right. Well, lucky us that you walked out of that room, although I would give anything to see you as an unsmiling Rockette. That would have been just
that
great.
Would be good right in the middle of the line, right?
Oh, God. That would have been great. You know, I loved this. I find myself, even when I'm sitting still, doing different things. But what about people who are aging and are in pain or are afraid? You've had a fall at very, I would say, late in life for a dancer. You had your first serious injury, I think at 69, going up on toe, broke your metatarsal. But, you know, sometimes that's the thing that, you know, people as they age, they say, I'm going to stop moving so I don't do that again.
Well, if you stop moving, chances are you will do that again. The thing that I find and have always found is you want to know what your body can do. You don't want to ask of it something that it's incapable of, but the only way to know what you can do is to try. So the notion of, say, pushing back of the isometrics, anybody can do this. Yeah. There may not be a great deal of strength in the body. There may be a lot of pain in the body, but the body can still move against itself and have some indication that it is alive and that from there it can move forward.
Yeah. Some of the exercises, they feel like yoga classes. You know, you put your arms up and then you flop over and then you swing your arms to one side and the other. You say it doesn't have to be that. It can be illustrate yourself, jut a hip out when you're talking to somebody or bring up your leg and slap it, expanding your space as you get older instead of pulling back in.
Look, I say it in many different ways, many different times in the book. We're lazy. We all are lazy. It's a part of being a human being. And it takes an effort. It takes a conscious effort to continue moving forward and to demanding a little more space than taking a little less space. Okay, it's a crowded bus. You got to be careful about the elbows and people are packed in. That's a different thing. But you don't want to get frozen in that position and you get in a bus that isn't so crowded. Then you can expand. But we forget to do that. Yeah. Our bodies have remembered the course of least resistance. Work less. No, work more.
It's not just the physical. There's, you know, just the openness that is being. You say, pick a friend, share something that will either fascinate or instruct the other every day, a daily miracle. It's also about movement towards friendships and people.
Yes, I think that the key word here is generous, that there's a generosity of spirit that wants to share, that does not see hoarding or possessing as an ultimate slash goal, but that the business of sharing is ever ongoing.
Generosity towards younger people, too. Make sure you don't...
Yes, even them. Yeah. Even them, yes.
That you don't present yourself as knowing it all, even though as Twyla Tharp, you may know a heck of a lot about your field.
Yes, but it's wise to assume that you still have something to learn.
Mm, yeah. Well, and plan. You reference climber Alex Honnold. We spoke with him. He's, of course, the subject of the movie Free Solo. They won the Oscar. And when he climbs these free climbs without ropes or anything, he plans every single step of the way. I mean, it sounds like you're just saying be mindful.
Mindful is a big word.
Yeah.
Planning is perhaps more mundane and pragmatic. It's simply having the nerve to visualize the endpoint you want to accomplish, not accepting that it might fail, assume, no, it is going to be as I see it, and then visualize every single move that is going to be necessary to accomplish that.
Well, and as you say, we're basically lazy. Or maybe some people are thinking, really, really keep moving? I was looking forward to not moving as I got older, but...
No, yeah. You're not.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm
not.
Might be, but forget it. You have to do it. You know, there's a friend came this morning, they were having a little difficult time, and said, oh, I don't feel so well. I feel this, I feel that, I feel. I go, forget it with the feeling. Go do. Go do something. Do will soon replace the emptiness of feeling and being out of control. Feelings are out of control. And go do something. You know, go wash a pan. Go grow a plant.
And when all else fails, put on John Philip Sousa. Do you still put on John Philip Sousa marches when you wake up?
Well, I perhaps give myself like 8 minutes before I put it on.
Really? And then you, John Philip Sousa, you start moving and marching to him.
Well, yeah, I don't do that 7 days a week. I do it maybe like 2 days a week.
What a great idea.
Right.
Again, I'd like to be a fly on that wall. Twyla Tharp, what is it that keeps you moving?
Curiosity. I'm curious. I find nothing to be worse than the restlessness that comes of feeling bored. So I keep wanting to ask even very small questions. It's part of the notion that no pledge becomes a goal, that a pledge is an ongoing pursuit and that it's accepted that, guess what, you're never going to win. You're going to be always on the pursuit of winning, but it will never happen to you. You will never have to be a winner because then, actually, ironically, in a way, when you win, you're done and you're dead. So, you know, just keep working towards the goal, but never expect nor accept that it's been accomplished.
Twyla Tharp, her book is Keep It Moving, Lessons for the Rest of Your Life. Twyla, thank you so much.
Of course, my pleasure. Thank you.
And Sousa's Mother Hubbard March, conducted by the over 80-year-old Keith Bryan. There may be something to this Sousa thing. Everybody move. It's here and now.
With people throughout the world taking to the streets in Hong Kong, Chile, Catalonia, Iran, and Lebanon, where the prime minister announced today he will resign after 2 weeks of protests there, it's safe to say that 2019 is shaping up to be the year of the protester. Joining us on Skype for more about these worldwide protests and what they mean is senior scholar at the Stone Center for Socioeconomic Inequality at CUNY, Branko Milanović.
Thank you very much. Nice to be there.
Now, the root causes of the civil unrest happening in places like I mentioned, Hong Kong, Lebanon, Catalonia, and Chile are very different, but there are some similarities. It really brings to mind for me the 1968 sense of global upheaval.
You know, if you go back to 1968, and actually I was then just out, I remember that because I was just out of elementary school, but I remember that period. Of course, the information traveled much more slowly than today. But the information did travel, you know, all of Europe, essentially, including Eastern Europe, for example, the strikes and civic movements in Poland and Yugoslavia happened in 1968 at the same time as in France. And obviously in the U.S. it actually happened in 1968. So I think that the information did travel and there were some commonalities. It was really a movement led, as we all remember from the pictures, even by young people then. And
that's
it was
right.
Really a movement that left really deep, I think, deep imprint on social landscape afterwards. It did not maybe make many political changes, but really socially, I think it was a very important movement. But nowadays, of course, the information travels much more fast. And of course, we know much better what other people are doing. I mean, practically in real time, if you look what happened in Chile or Hong Kong. And look at a small example. In Barcelona, they imitated actually what Hong Kong did by closing off the railroad station and the airport. So clearly that was an effect sort of which was driven by social media, by the knowledge of what is happening elsewhere.
Some of the reasons that we're seeing these civil unrests, really, they are very different. There are different things happening in those regions. But let's use Chile as an example. Protests there have been nonstop. There have been more than a dozen people shot and killed. We actually had a conversation with someone covering the region last week who talked about the anger people felt over the increase in metro fares there. But there's a lot more there. What's driving people to the streets?
Obviously, the original trigger in Chile was the increase in the fare. But, you know, it's like in Hong Kong. The original trigger in Hong Kong was an extradition bill, which actually really was targeting sort of heinous, horrible crimes, nothing to do with political issues. But this is the tip of the iceberg. Once you have something which basically is a trigger, then, of course, other things, if people are unhappy generally with something, then these other things come up. And I think that actually people get emboldened, I think both in the case of Chile and in case of Hong Kong, by seeing how many other people feel like they do. And I think that essentially it's a kind of a snowball effect that people take to the streets. But to go back simply to the case of Chile, because I didn't answer, I think in the case of Chile, I think it is clear that underneath the protest and the reason for protest is really extremely high inequality in income and even greater inequality in wealth. And the fact that the poor people are just basically excluded from quite remarkable income growth that has occurred in Chile over the last 40 years. So I think in that case, I think the reason for the protest is relatively clear.
We're talking about a lot of violence in these cases. As I said, Chile, there have been more than a dozen people killed. What can we expect as people continue to take to the streets? You know, this type of action can only go on for so long.
That's true. And of course, the reason why Chile, I think, was so shocking is because Chile is first a democratic country, secondly, a rich country. And you don't expect when you have protests in democratic and rich countries that the first thing that is done is bringing out the army in the streets and they start shooting with live ammunition. That's really totally unexpected. Of course, on the other hand, you had, I think, almost 100 people who were killed in Iraq. But we might have, unfortunately, gotten used to extremely high level of violence in Iraq. So that goes a little bit unnoticed, or it's just simply mentioned in the news. But I think that was, of course, not all dead are equal, unfortunately. You know, we treat some people who are victims differently from the others.
Is there a through line, a commonality that we're seeing with all of these protests that are happening around the world? And what does that tell us?
I would say that a common line is the feeling of sort of being forgotten, left aside, and not really participating in the social and political life of a country to the extent that, you know, people would like to be consulted or actually obviously have their incomes increase and so on. So I think that there is a sort of a feeling of maybe, how should I say, exclusion, or maybe also the feeling that the elites are treating them in a contemptuous manner that people really react against.
That's Branko Milanović. He is at the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality at CUNY. Thank you so much for this conversation, Branko.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.